Hello and welcome to the CRV Podcast. My name is Jeff Wright. I'm one of the regular contributors to the CRV website. On this episode, I am speaking with Corey Higdon about his piece in Providence magazine titled The Death of History, which addresses the effect of critical theory on the historical process. We also discuss some of the ways these same forces are at play in the Southern Baptist Convention. Corey did his undergraduate work at the University of Memphis in political science and holds a Master's of Divinity from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in church history. He is currently working on his PhD at Southern, where he is Director of Theological Research in the Office of the President. All right, let's get going on my conversation with Corey Higdon. Hey, Corey Higdon, thank you for coming on the podcast. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, we are very thankful. And you hit our radar over at CRV with a piece you published in Providence. And I want to talk to you about a whole bunch of that. And I'm going to, in fact, if you're okay with it, I'm going to read some excerpts for our listeners. But before we get started doing that, could you let our listeners know where you're from, how the Lord converted you, and what you're currently doing vocationally?
Absolutely. So I'm from Columbia, Tennessee, which is about an hour south of Nashville. And I didn't really grow up going to church. My family, you know, took me to church every now and then. We would kind of have these spurts where we'd be at church every Sunday, and then, you know, just kind of dissipated. But in my sophomore year of high school, a neighborhood friend of mine started inviting me to a church there in town, and I started going with him pretty regularly, you know, every Sunday, every Wednesday. And there was this youth conference one weekend, and a guy came, he delivered a message, and he invited everybody up to the front to pray a prayer and was offering salvation through that prayer. So I prayed it, and was led into a room after that where I was told, hey, because you prayed that prayer, you're saved, and you're good to go now, which sounded like a pretty good deal to me. But shortly after that, I mean, it didn't take long. That fizzled quickly, especially once I got into college and I went to the University of Memphis. And any kind of connection to Christianity, any love for Christ, anything that was drawing me to the church just completely fell apart. I was totally invested in my career, totally invested in just my own ambition and my own pursuit. And it wasn't until my senior year of college where the Lord really just began to break down a lot of idols in my life. I was pretty successful as a college student. I was involved in politics and had worked on a lot of campaigns and worked for a political party. I was doing really well. And over the course of a year, the Lord just broke those idols down one after another. And through that process of being broken, which was just enormously painful, I was just lonely. I felt empty. And I think just my whole sense of identity was being taken out from under me. And God graciously sent people into my life there at college with a ministry called Campus Outreach. One person in particular who was the best man at my wedding, he just befriended me and loved on me and continually shared the gospel with me over and over and over again. And He and I were at a church meeting, and guy was preaching and proclaiming the gospel. And I remember the moment right at the end where he was describing that Christ descended from heaven for us, and that's how much he loved us. He was preaching the gospel through the Great Commission. And it was through that the Lord just opened my eyes to his love for me, my identity that's offered in Christ through the gospel. And it was at that moment I committed my life to him and just wanted to know him more, loved his word, wanted to study his word, wanted to read his word all the time, wanted to be around God's people. And it wasn't long after that I began to feel a call to ministry. And long story short, did a couple years working on staff with Campus Outreach doing college ministry at Rhodes College, which is also in Memphis. And then after some clarification, the Lord drew me to Southern Seminary, where I earned my master's, and currently I'm working on my PhD.
What's your PhD aimed at?
So my PhD is in church history, and specifically looking at Roger Williams and religious freedom, looking at political theology in the 17th century.
Oh, wonderful! Well, that is such a blessing and such a good transition into your piece on the death of history in the U.S. If you'll indulge me, I'm going to read, as I mentioned, a couple excerpts from the piece in Providence Mag, and maybe follow up on that with you. The first one says this: history suffers from an apparent terminal illness. It is quickly dying and dying before our eyes. In the death of history, we lose a cherished friend who always invited us into a rich, burgeoning narrative of humanity filled with both tragedy and triumph, raising and restoration, inciting with us an amalgam of emotions and ideas, all in an effort, as historian Wilfred McClay contends, to forge a, quote, sense of continuity with the past. We are narrative creatures, and we are all drawn, whether we realize it or not, to history and the myriad of stories that must be told. Far from death by natural causes, history is yet another casualty of identity politics. That is a killer paragraph. I've sort of cut a few chunks out there, but that's an arresting paragraph. I guess I'd like to follow up by just starting by asking, how did you first become aware of the demise of history in the way you're describing it, and what were some of the key indicators?
Yeah, so it all kind of began in the fall of 2019. So it was at that time that the 1619 Project came out, which, if your listeners aren't aware, is just a pretty insidious project that the New York Times started. That was coming out, and then I was participating in some historical academic conferences. They were secular; it wasn't, you know, with the Evangelical Theological Society. These were secular historical societies, and I was presenting some papers, and it was at these conferences that I really began to get a sense that something was amiss. So I presented a paper talking about demonology in 17th century Puritans. And after my paper, the moderator for our panel came up to me afterwards, and he pulled me aside and he said, "Hey, you can't ever come here and do that again." Hmm. And I said, "Well, what is that you're referring to?" And he said, "Well, you took religion and theology seriously in the lives of the historical subjects that you talked about. We don't do that here. We don't take religion or theology seriously." And just threw me off. I was like, I don't even understand what it is that you're talking about. That same conference, I was on another panel. I presented another paper, and there's a guy on the panel. And this is where things really began to clear up for me what was going on. There's a guy on the panel with me who was presenting a paper. This is going to sound absolutely mind-numbingly boring, and to some extent it was, but it was really quite insidious what he was doing. This guy was giving a paper on transitioning attitudes towards sulfur in 17th century England. And that might just sound ridiculous. Why would anybody be interested in that? Well, here's what he was doing. Sulfur carried with it during that time, or at least before it, very deeply embedded theological connotations of death and the devil, so that when people smelled sulfur, it brought about within the notions of hell. Sulfur was used in sermons to talk about and to describe in a way that hit the senses hell. Well, what he was saying is during his paper, he was saying that during the 7th century, those attitudes began to change theologically because of economic and military reasons. So sulfur became important economically to England. It also became important with the rise of gunpowder. So his entire argument was that theology, and he was saying this broadly, not even just about a specific paper, but his broader point was that theology is subservient to the powers that be at whatever political moment in time. So theology will serve whatever is the driving economic and power force at that time. So sulfur was needed for England at that time, which meant that the theology had to change with it. And so there was this entire power dynamic, and it was an insidious, difficult paper to hear that completely just didn't take into account the historical complexities of, for example, the Reformation and how that began to change the spirituality of that time. But again, for historians like this, theology just doesn't matter. It isn't even a consideration. And so it was through that experience that I began to see something is not right in the study of history. And it's not like I discovered it. I'm a Johnny come lately to this discussion, quite honestly, but it was through that personal experience, I began to see things are amiss.
Well, you also made the point that humans are narrative creatures, and that's a That's a point I'm very sympathetic to. Clearly, this gentleman you're talking about presenting the paper on changing relationship to sulfur is attempting a narrative to house human history in a particular narrative. So could you maybe elaborate on why locating yourself in the right story, maybe I would even say the, you know, the objectively historic story, is important for human beings to flourish?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the point I was making in the article was to suggest that all of us, everybody, whether you recognize it or not, you're drawn to history just by the fact that we love stories. Whether you like reading them or you like watching them in movies, we're all drawn to stories. We love a good story. We love being told stories, and we love telling stories. And for Christians, I mean, you just think about our scripture is predominantly, overwhelmingly narrative. And it's compelling narrative. So the point I was making in the article is that stories are so essential to who we are as human beings. It's essential to who we are as Christians just by the fact of our Bible and how God has chosen to reveal himself to us, namely through narrative. But it's especially, I think, important for us, as your question is getting at. We absolutely have to think objectively, to think carefully about historical questions, because, and as we'll get into later as we discuss the article, if we approach the past with a certain malice or political agenda, we're going to reframe an entire story, an entire narrative that's just inevitably going to have contemporary ramifications. So this example I gave about this guy at the historical society. Yeah, he's talking about something that happened in the 1600s in England, but he's making the same argument today. He would be making the same kind of case about the way theology is conducted today. It is, theology is subservient. Theology is just a tool that the powers that be use to enact a system of oppression. And so it's so important for us as we connect ourselves to the past and we look at history that we think carefully, that we approach history with the right kind of virtues, that we approach history with patience and honestly with a passion to just tell the truth as it happened and to not approach history. It's hard to do this, and we're all somewhat guided by an agenda, but as best as we can to lay aside those agendas and let the truth stand and let the story stand on its own.
So with that point on the table, that what we understand about history and the way the world worked in history informs the way we understand the world today, sort of floating in our minds, is it possible to use history, and I'm assuming you're going to come out in the affirmative, to use history over and against the common good? Is that a weapon available to those who are working in history as a discipline?
Oh, absolutely. So I think you see this just taking place, for example, in the streets of America right now, with all this unrest. You see this with, again, the 1619 Project. It's history is being picked up as a weapon, and it's being used to bludgeon anybody who dares to defy the narrative that political activists are trying to push. And I make very clear in the article, it doesn't matter if you're conservative, if you're on the right, if you're on the left, there are people guilty of this from all political stripes. You can pick your own favorite quote and peddle this narrative as if it's true because you want it to be true. And because you've pulled these quotes out or you've sliced these quotes out of context and you write about it, anybody who disagrees with you, you just say, well, you're just not in accord with the facts. You don't care about the facts. You don't care about the truth. It happens on the right and on the left. And that absolutely has enormous connotations with our pursuit of the common good. And the point I make in the article is that actually what's happening right now is that there is a connection between the demise of our ability to actually do history well and to think historically rightly and the demise of public discourse in America. So if you defend George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson, while noting the enormous vices in their character, while noting their positions on slavery, If you dare to do that, you're immediately going to be labeled as a bigot. you're immediately going to be drugged through this kind of rhetorical mud. And if you are a professor at a major university, you're going to be put on probation. You're going to be suspended because you dared to teach something that was, again, this politically motivated story that's being peddled by especially folks on the left. And so there's an erosion of our ability to even have reasonable disagreement because we bought into these stories that just quite frankly are half truth, but we're peddling them as if they're gospel. And then if you don't get on board with this story, you must be a bigot. You must be part of this attempt to oppress. You're part of the problem, and you must be silenced. That's absolutely going to have detrimental effects for the common good, and especially for American democracy, which thrives off of an open and free public square where reasonable disagreements can be heard.
So would it be fair then to say that sort of this using history as a bludgeon prevents the discourse that's at the heart of us trying to live into a better future as people in this phase of history? Is that what you mean by saying we can't have discourse?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's happening right now, you know, you just see cancel culture over and over in the headline. This idea that if you're not on board with this new socially prescribed orthodoxy and you are not going to form, then you have to be canceled. You have to be shut down. Your voice is not one that can be heard. And so that's exactly what happened to me in that first story I told, where I took theology seriously in the lives of people that I discussed historically. And I was told, I can't do that here. And actually what he said to me after that was that if you ever do that again, historians are going to, we're going to kick your tail. He didn't use tail. He used an expletive. It's this whole, it doesn't matter what your scholarship is. It doesn't matter the depth of your research. It doesn't matter the facts that you bring to the table. None of that matters. If you don't get on board with our worldview and the way that we see things, you cannot be part of the discussion, period.
Well, so we've kind of gotten into a lot of the content from the next section from your piece I wanted to raise, but I want to put it in front of our listeners who haven't read it and follow up on it a little bit. You wrote later in your piece, indeed, there is a direct correlation with the demise of history and our ability to engage in public discourse. The politicization of the historical record has consequently corroded civility in American democracy, anathematizing even the appearance of an idea or worldview that is contrary to the cultural orthodoxy. In short, proponents of identity politics, here's that phrase again, have brandished history as a weapon, refitting it for malicious purposes. To be clear, conservatives are just as culpable and guilty of abusing history for their own political purposes, but the left is far more organized and insidious in its deployment of history as a rhetorical weapon. The product is a cherry-picked, half-baked, out-of-context story from the past intended to bludgeon anyone who dares to defend, say, the accomplishment of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, or Martin Luther King Jr. Contemporary concerns guided by malevolent identity politics and critical theory inevitably contort the historical record into a disfigured creature that is unrecognizable with what actually happened. Again, very, very weighty and compelling paragraph from you. I teach rhetoric to high school students, and one of the things I have to deal with is sort of the negative association with the term rhetoric in our society. We think of people trying to manipulate us, and certainly rhetoric has that has that reputation for good reason and practical experience. But I wonder if is it fair if I'm following your reading to see that the more objective discipline of history is being turned into a subjective kind of rhetoric, aiming at what you're calling here insidious purposes and our current cultural orthodoxy. Do you see a devaluation of history by bringing it under the heading of subjective rhetoric?
Absolutely. And that's, I thought quite a while about the title of the article, and that's why I landed on the death of history. I say later in the article that history, the way that I've described it here, using it for those subjective purposes, we just need to be clear, that's not history. That's fundamentally not history. It's not to say that historians don't make arguments. They certainly do. I mean, history, it is objective in the sense in that there is a historical record. There are places that we go to verify the arguments that we make. So in that sense, it is objective, but any good historian is going to make an argument, even from those verified records. The problem, what's happening, is approaching those historical records with a very specific agenda. And what I've identified there is this kind of identity politics, critical theory. And so, again, I think the best example of this is the 1619 Project, where the New York Times goes in and is trying to reframe the totality of American history around one year and around something that happened in that year, which was bringing slavery into the American colony. And so they stated at the outset that they wanted to reframe the entire history of America off of that event. And they say things in there that American exceptionalism is completely and totally built on the institution of slavery. They reframe the entire American Revolution as an act to defend and perpetuate the institution of slavery. They make all of these claims as if they are historically true. They pull out a few quotes here and there as evidentiary tools. But the problem with that is that it ignores the enormous complexity of the topic that is history. And so you don't have to take this from me. I mean, I'm a nobody. I'm just a PhD student, historian wannabe. But there are, when the 1619 Project landed, some of the most eminent historians in the field, on the right and on the left, I mean, not even just evangelical historians, they immediately condemn the 1619 Project, saying that it completely promotes a very simplified, out-of-context, poor retelling of American history. But they're doing it because they have a very specific political purpose in mind. And so what's happened is the subjective sort of purposes that they have in this contemporary moment, coupled with their commitment to critical theory and identity politics, is coloring the entire way they approach the historical record. And it's going to control the entire way they tell that story. And the product is really just something that is out of accord with what actually happened. It leaves people with, I mean, the only conclusion that you can then draw is that the entire American experiment was wicked from the very beginning all the way back in 1619. That it's entirely an oppressive institution that perpetuates and continues to perpetuate oppression. That has enormous consequences for the way we think about America today and our responsibilities politically today. But that entire approach to history, I argue in this article, that's not history. We don't need to call it history because it operates off of an erroneous historiographical approach that's riddled with historical fallacies. And if I make the case at the end of the article, it operates off of a horrible anthropology.
Well, that anthropology is something I would like to talk to you about further. Could you elaborate on what the anthropology is that the New York Times' 1619 Project is working from?
Yeah, so they're looking at everything through group dynamics, and they're looking at everything through the lens of oppressor and oppressed, and that if you fall into the category of the oppressor class, your entire story, everything you do, is animated by the desire to be an oppressor. For Christians, we cannot operate that way. And for Christian historians, you just fundamentally cannot approach the past that way. And so you even think about in the Bible, we have people like King David, who is a man after God's own heart, who is listed in the book of Hebrews as being a hero of the faith, who at the same time committed adultery, who at the same time was complicit in murder, who at the same time disobeyed God in some very egregious ways. But God still says of David, a man after his own heart. Well, I mean, how can you do that? How can... For critical theory or for what is going on with the 1619 Project or historians who are operating off of that kind of an anthropology, they're going to look at David and just label him as oppressor class, and his entire life is going to be colored that way. Whereas Christians, we understand there's just enormous complexities in who we are as human beings, that within the same person, we understand more than anybody the full depth of human depravity and where that can take us, where that can take any of us. But at the same time, we see the common grace of God working in and through all people to bring about enormous good. So that to bring it into the American context, you can have a person like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, who defended the institution of slavery, who owned slaves, and we need to be honest with that, and we need to tell that story, but we also have to be honest with the enormous good that they accomplished. The ideas that they put forward that they didn't live perfectly to, that they didn't espouse, or that they espoused but they didn't adhere to perfectly, the fact of the matter is that all of us. But that's part of the story that we have to tell. But what you have happening in the Historical Academy, what you have happening with the 1619 Project, you can't even tell the story where enormous good happened because it falls outside of that operative worldview, oppressor, oppressed. Jefferson, Washington, the founding generation, they're all part of this institution of slavery and trying to continue it, trying to promote it. And that's the only story that can be told.
Those names, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, they appear in your piece alongside Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr. And to be honest, even as someone who tries to stay as conversant with the shifting winds of culture and virtue as seen by our common culture, I've not gotten over being surprised that someone on that list could be criticized on the basis of their public work being inadequate. And yet here we are. And so when I hear you naming them and talking about defining them in these categories of oppressor or defining them in some ways by what they failed to accomplish, Christians, should we be wary on the point of bearing false witness about our departed neighbors, that we are doing a disservice to our Creator, their Creator, and them as Christians by kind of letting these narratives coalesce around failure rather than what good was accomplished in their day?
Yeah, absolutely. I've said this before, and I say it sometimes tongue in cheek, but at the same time, I'm quite serious about it. I think the best historians out there should be Christian historians because we are absolutely convinced that the truth has to be told. The truth sets people free. Now, of course, that we're talking there about the gospel, but there is a commitment to the truth that must be told. And to me, that is so much more of an enriching, fulfilling story to tell. It keeps us away from hero worship, but it also reminds us of the depths of human depravity. It reminds us of our own humanity, of our own frailty. I say in the article, if all of these people, if all these names are just summed up with their faults, then who among us is left? Who among us thinks that we're so self-righteous that we can cast the first stone? And so Christians ought to be the best historians because of our commitment to the truth, because of our understanding of sin and human depravity, but also because of our understanding of God's common grace. That's not bound by or halted by human sinfulness. God is going to accomplish his purposes no matter what, and his grace is not going to be stopped by human purposes. And so Christians, when we see these things, when we see false narratives, when we engage in the task of history ourselves, we need to be careful that what we are after is the truth, because that is our commitment as Christians. We have to be committed to the truth. And those kinds of stories, in my opinion, are the stories I love reading. They're the stories that I think are far more compelling than a cherry-picked narrative, whether it comes from the right or from the left.
Well, this is a Southern Baptist Facing podcast, and you're a Southern Baptist working at a Southern Baptist Institution. I'd like to maybe look toward the convention in just a second, but before we leave the topic of the broader cultural moment, I'm going to ask you to comment on something that I would just like a historian's scrutiny of. It appears that this process that we're talking about around the 1619 Project, of saying the entire American project has been fundamentally built on slavery and the moral wickedness it represents, that has extended, you know, through the whole project. Is it fair to suspect that the end goal or the end result, maybe, is just necessarily going to be the collapse of the social order that is built on these wicked things. Because I look at the stuff you're talking about and I think, well, this is maybe if I grant them as much as I can, they think they have diagnosed a problem. But if we play out what they see as a problem, there's nothing we can build on, certainly nothing we can build with. All we can do is sort of reduce everything to the rubble and look around and say, well, we tore it down. Do you think that's fair, or am I too cynical?
No, I think if you really honestly talk to some of these folks, I don't think they're maybe some of them at least are trying to be just intentionally destructive.
Sure.
And just to blow the whole thing out of the water. But I don't see how you get away from that. So to give you another example, a book came out a couple years ago called Religious Freedom: The Contested History of an American Ideal. And the author of the book says in the book that there is no such thing as religious freedom. Very provocative phrase. You think, where on earth is this going? And what the author argues is that religious freedom is a made up, socially constructed tool of religious majorities used to enact empire building and to subject their will over religious minorities. And that's all religious freedom is. You take that argument into a contemporary moment where religious liberty is just enormously contested in every single sphere of the public sector. What are you left with? If you buy that argument, what are you left with when a cake baker makes a claim of religious freedom to not bake a cake? What is your assumption of the motive and intent of that person? If the entire idea of religious freedom is, as this author suggests, a socially constructed tool used to enact oppression, that's exactly where some of this stuff is going. It's just destructive. It's ripping apart the societal fabric that has made, I think, the American constitutional order strong and a good. It's ripping away those constitutional liberties that are precious. And I think even as Baptists, we would say the freedom of the conscience is not just something that the American Constitution just sort of discovered. That is something that we believe is given to us by God. And if you follow the trajectory of all of this stuff going on in the historical academy, its aim is to destroy all of these wonderful things, to label them as tools of evil and wickedness. And once they're gone, I think you're absolutely right. What are we left with? We've torn it down. What are we left with? And I don't think they have an answer. I don't want to say that they're just intentionally trying to be destructive, but that's the end goal. Not only are they doing history poorly, but they're leaving us in a contemporary moment where we're having to look around at things like religious freedom and say, well, if we just get rid of it, what are we left with? And I don't think they have an answer.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that answer, bleak as it may be. So to shift to the SBC, your point about, again, Thomas Jefferson, MLK, I find very compelling. But as a Southern Baptist, it isn't hard for me to connect from there to the founding of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is historically connected to a pro-slavery commitment. So what counsel would you give believers of good faith as they want to think about the history of the SBC appropriately?
Yeah, so I'll point people to a historian I quoted in the article, a historian by the name of Gordon Wood, who wrote a wonderful book called The Radicalism of the American Revolution. And he says in the introduction, I'm quoting him, he says, "To focus on what the revolution, or any historical event for that matter, did not accomplish, highlighting and lamenting its failure to abolish slavery and change fundamentally the lot of women, is to miss the great significance of what it did accomplish." I think that's an enormously helpful guide there from Gordon Wood. And what I would say for Southern Baptists, we cannot shy away from the truth of our history. We have to tell that story. We have to be open and honest about it. We need to be the ones telling that story to the broader culture. We need to be the ones carefully thinking through these issues. At the same time, however, we cannot adopt the same kind of insidious anthropology that you find with the peddlers of the 1619 Project or other historical projects similar to it, where we sit in a seat of judgment as if we are higher and superior where we jettison essential Christian virtues such as patience and charity, kindness and love. Those have to mark us as we approach any historical narrative, but especially our past. So I think as we think through the Southern Baptist thinking about the history of the SBC, don't reduce it to the sum of its failure, but also be boldly honest about that story. And don't shy away from it. Don't be afraid of it. Tell the story as it happened. But the thing is that the SBC didn't end. The story of the SBC didn't end in the 1860s. It continues forward, and there's a story yet to tell. And you follow that story, and you follow its progress, and you keep telling it, and you keep going back to that narrative, and you watch what happened. That's a very compelling narrative. I think for Christians, we have a word for that: it's redemption. It's intrinsically connected to the gospel. That there were horrible failures within our history, but that's not the full story. I think that's exactly what we have to do as we approach our own story, to not be afraid of the truth, but to trace it out from beginning to end. And I think in that it's going to humble us. It's going to make us much more charitable, much more patient. It's going to make us much more aware of our own sins and our own failures and our own fault. But I think also it's going to give us hope in the gospel, in God's grace, that the SBC, which historically with its commitments to slavery, God could still use it to accomplish enormous good. What on earth, who are we that we get to be part of what God is doing around the world, given our history? There's no other way to explain it than the gospel. And so I think that's what I would counsel people within the SBC as they think about these issues.
Well, yes, and amen, brother. Thank you for that. You have been incredibly generous with your time, and we so appreciate that. Maybe to end kind of on the trajectory of optimism and good things, I'll finish with this question, and some of it you've already set us up for, but how do Christians listening to this interview, how do we cultivate a high view of history and give ourselves to faithfully living within our assigned portion of history?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing I would say is read good history books. Just read good history. Read biography. Pick up good books that are going to bring you into those stories and bring you into those narratives. We're not going to get better at telling our story. We're not going to get better at doing history if we don't read it. We don't actually dive into the narrative. Unfortunately, when people pontificate, whether on social media or wherever, about historical things, they often peddle facts which are actually just fallacious, completely, entirely, and not based in anything. And so, I think for Christians, we ought to be guided, again, as I said earlier, by that singular devotion and commitment for the truth. And so just reading good history books and seeing how it's written and cultivating that desire to know the past more and how to think historically, how to think carefully about our past. And I think to your second question, just living faithfully within our own moment, I think what's going on right now in the contemporary culture, the chaos and the mayhem, there was, I didn't say this in the article, but some of what was undergirding it, what was there, the less academic way of saying this would have been, everybody just needs to calm down. Everybody just needs to get off social media for a moment. Everybody just needs to take a breather. And I think especially for Christians in this very volatile moment, we ought to be the people showing the world what love is, what patience is. We ought to be showing the world what kindness is and charity. That colors the way we do history. That ought to animate the way we live our lives at this very moment. And the reason we approach history that way and the reason that we want to live that way at this moment, because of what God has done for us in the gospel. And so in our present moment, as we're looking at all of the chaos, I would just encourage Christians, be kind, be patient, be loving, even when some of the stuff we're seeing out there just infuriates us, we have to approach this with a Christ exalting patience and kindness that's guided by a humility, because we know of our own fallenness, our own sinfulness, and where we would be apart from Christ. That's what I think this moment in America needs right now. It needs Christians who are emulating those Christ exalting virtues of patience, kindness, and love.
Well, again, yes and amen, brother. Thank you for that. So listeners, Corey is one of these gentlemen who practices what he advocates for, and so he is not available on social media, but he has written for Providence Magazine, as we have mentioned, for Public Discourse. You've got to go read, as a starting place, his piece, The Death of History, in Providence Mag, and then from there, follow out the rest of his writing. I will put a link to that piece in the show notes. And Corey, thank you again for your time this afternoon. You've been very generous.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. I appreciate being asked to come on the program.
Thanks again to Corey Higdon for his time. Check the show notes for a link to his article, The Death of History, for Providence Magazine. And thank you for listening to this episode of the CRV Podcast. If you have enjoyed this episode, we would appreciate you leaving us a review on your favorite podcast platform and telling a friend about the podcast. For all the folks at CRV, I'm Jeff Wright, wishing you all the best in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ.